Two messages before we get started. First, based on what you're about to hear in this interview, if you ever find yourself saying, I would like to do interviews the way Andrew does, well, then I'm going to tell you, I want to help. All you have to do is go to any page on Mixergy and just like this, type in interview your heroes, and you'll be taken to this page, which has a video of the course where I teach my process in detail. On this page, you'll also see scripts that I use to recruit guests and so much else, so much more that can help you. All you have to do is go to mixergypremium.com and you'll see it there. Second, this interview is sponsored, like just about every other interview on Mixergy, by Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. Scott is a lawyer that has helped out the startup community for years. I've known him for years, but you do not have to take my word for it. You can just scroll down on his webpage and you'll see all the testimonials from people who you know and respect. WalkerCorporateLaw.com. Let's get started. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner, and I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And I have to tell you very, very openly, sometimes when I watch people build multi-million dollar businesses online by teaching, there's a part of me that says, maybe I should do it. But then there's another part of me that just pops in that goes, who are you to teach anything? You're not the world's expert. There's someone else who's so much better than you. And usually at that point, there's a vision of that someone else that comes into my mind. And so I hesitate. Do you ever feel that way? If you do, I think this interview will be especially helpful to you because of the process that today's guest took to build his company. Eric Bond founded Beat the GMAT, a site that helps people prep for the test. Before he ever took the GMAT, he launched this business. He did it as a way of talking publicly and being held accountable as he learned and prepped for his test. Throughout that process and afterwards, he bootstrapped and sold a profitable business. I invited him here to talk about how he did it. Eric, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew. And I have to say, if you are already a great teacher to startup guys like me. So I think you're already there.
I appreciate that. And you and I were talking before we started about how you were one of the first people to buy a course that I created, the first one about how to interview. What made you want to take that?
So at the time, I was in a place in my business where we were starting to do a lot more video content, and I wasn't really that happy with the quality of the videos that we're producing. So I've always been a fan of Mixergy, checked the site pretty regularly, and when I saw that you were putting together a course that basically explained how you do these videos every day, I immediately pulled out my money and gave it to you. A little funny story. So when I discovered it, I was actually in a four-hour layover in Dubai waiting for my flight to India, and totally jet-lagged. But when I started watching your, I think it was a two-hour course at 2:30 in the morning or something, it kept me wired and awake, actually, during that entire layover. I was so jazzed because it's such a tactical course. So for those of you who are listening and out there, it's definitely worth checking out. It's been a very valuable course for me and my business. I think we produced over 250 videos to date. Wow. Using some of those techniques.
Well, I'm proud to have been even a small part of that. And it's called Interview Your Heroes. It's the first one I ever put out, and it's on the site. And sometimes I look out on the internet and I see people using exactly what I did and what I talked about there. And I think maybe I'm creating these imitators, but I know that that's a weak thought. The prouder thought that comes over me is, hey, maybe I can teach something. Maybe it does work what I'm talking about. And definitely does. I've seen it for other people, and it just encourages me to keep going. There's something more meaningful in me, Eric, than teaching people how to interview or even doing interviews. And so if this process of teaching people how I do that works, I think once that more meaningful part comes out, I can make that work too. I'm just starting to get all in my, not in my head. I'm having a hard time expressing it. Anyway, what I'll say is thank you for saying that, and I'll move on with your story. And the part that I thought we can really start with is the ATM story. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think I do.
What happened there?
So this was actually the day that I closed the sale of our business, last October 2012. And I remember that I needed to get $40 from the ATM. I didn't have any cash on me for a haircut. And when I looked at my receipts, I saw many, many zeros that had not been there. I realized that the wire had gone through. So for a guy who has consistently had less than $1,000 in his checking account, it was quite startling, actually. And I, in
Wow.
fact, still have that receipt. It really kind of floored me when I saw that.
Where's that receipt now?
So this is I'm going to reveal a little bit of secret. So behind me actually is a Beat the GMAT sign. It's actually one of our first logos when the company was getting formed, and I had it framed. I'm a little bit of a sentimental guy, and I have taped it, that receipt, actually to the back of the frame. So hopefully I'm not revealing too much in case you guys plan to break into my house a little bit later.
How many zeros in that receipt?
Unfortunately, I can't reveal specifically how many zeros. Right now I'm under confidentiality still with my company. But it was a lot, and it was more than I've ever seen. And I will say this, it was enough to get me financial independence, which is pretty much the greatest thing that you can buy.
Why? What are you able to do now that you couldn't do before? How'd your life change?
I think that fundamentally my life didn't change that much. So that this is one thing that was kind of interesting when you sell your business. It's a little bit anticlimactic in some sense. I mean, I still drive the same Honda Accord 2005. Our quality of life has not significantly changed. It was already pretty good, I'd say. I eat out when I want to, and my wife and I enjoy an occasional vacation. But the thing that changed was, I guess, the psychology around my outlook of life. I think that now I'm in a position where, if I want, I could take a lot more risks in terms of being more picky about the projects that I want to work on, or just even having the freedom of knowing that if I needed to take some time off, focus on family or focus on photography, one of my burgeoning passions, I could do that and come back and work on whatever projects are available at that point. I think a part of it also was a little bit of just gaining a little bit more swagger in my step, in the sense that I feel a little bit more validated that if I go after projects, I've already been proven that the skills that I've learned so far have been successful, and hopefully I can take those to do other ventures too.
All right, this is a really exciting story. Because of the way you launched, we're going to talk about the Blogspot launch that you did, the open
Sure.
source forum that you built up to, the way you didn't end up getting funding and what you did to fund the business instead. And we'll talk about how you built up your community. But before you ever did this, before Beat the GMAT, was something called Mass Appeal Games. What is Mass Appeal Games and what happened to it?
Yeah, so just a quick timeline check. I actually did start Beat the GMAT before Mass Appeal Games, but Mass Appeal Games was a project that happened before I went full time on Beat the GMAT. So Beat the GMAT was a side project for many years.
And you were in Intuit for the whole time you were doing both of these
That's
projects.
right. There was one point where I was running three businesses, a terrible idea, actually. But Mass Appeal Games was a very interesting failure. Maybe I shouldn't even really call it a failure because I learned so much from it. This was an exercise of pure greed. So what happened was back in, let's call it like 2008 or so, it was the Wild West in terms of the Facebook platform just coming out and folks creating these very, very simple games on the Facebook platform that created tremendous virality. You can go from 0 to 1 million users like overnight. And amazing amounts of money through microtransactions, like purchasing virtual goods, in this case, maybe like small weapons in Mafia Wars or a purple cow in Farmville. And my reaction to that was, hey, why don't I get some smart guys together and let's just go after the pie? Here's the problem, though. I am not passionate about games at all. I don't play video games. I'm not a gamer in any sense. The reason why I entered that space was purely out of the greed of seeing some opportunity there that I could grab a piece of. And as a result, I think that drove probably the majority, that was probably the primary driver of our failure because I didn't have the instincts to develop a really fun game. I didn't really, my heart wasn't really in it either. My passions are more around education, not around
So,
microtransactions
give an
and
example of how you missed something because I feel like you're smart enough. Maybe you're not fully passionate, but the environment was growing so quickly, the platform was growing so quickly that maybe it would have helped hide the fact that you didn't know enough.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't want to undercount the fact, too, the rest of my team. So I had five other teammates that were working on this, and they were all incredibly smart, too. But what I find actually in the work that I do, and I find this among a lot of my peers, too, and this isn't universal, is that when you can tie together a personal passion or a major interest that you have in your life, or a problem that you're dying to solve with some sort of venture or business that's trying to solve that problem, you tend to do better work. And for me, I just didn't have that fire inside of me to develop that passion, like understand the absolute nuances that it takes to create a viral game. And as the lead product manager, I think I was certainly responsible in a large part for that shortfall.
I see.
And so the lesson that I learned there was it's not enough always to just go into business only for the money, because there's going to be really hard times. And if you're just chasing money, that may not be enough to carry you through. And that was certainly the case for us. We had to shut our doors after 18 months.
Wow. And at the same time, then you were building Beat the GMAT and the.
Yeah, we certainly were. And that was actually a time where the site suffered quite a bit. So the Beat the GMAT site at that point was actually quite cash flow positive and was funding much of the development for Mass Appeal Games.
Really?
And but we were ignoring the community for a year and a half. And as a result, that created a lot more problems downstream for us in our history, because we allowed some competitors to come in, innovate really quickly in our space. And when we were able to refocus our energy back into Beat the GMAT, we found that it was a much more competitive environment.
Going to come back and ask you about the innovation that happened and how people could out-innovate you in this space. But the original idea came from you wanting to go to business school, and you decided if you're going to take the test that you needed to get there, you might as well do what?
Yeah, so get the MBA. That's what people were telling me. Just so how the story begins is back in 2005, I was sitting in my dorm room and I was clutching a piece of paper, which is my master's degree in sociology. And it was at that moment when I realized, oh my gosh, I think I'm eminently unemployable, and that I didn't do computer science, I didn't do econ. A lot of peers in Silicon Valley, I went to college out here, were kind of well in the engineering path and doing really neat things. So I did what everyone told me to do, which was to get an MBA. Or at least pursue one. Funny story, I actually never ended up getting an MBA. We could talk about that in a bit too. So I decided to prepare for the GMAT test. It's the entrance exam that's required for MBA programs worldwide. But the problem was I didn't have any money, so I couldn't pay the $1,500 to buy a course, which is usually the typical rate. And so I just got some library books, a few books from the bookstore. And I decided, hey, wouldn't it be cool if I just posted my study log of how I prepared for the GMAT from day one through day 60? And maybe someday someone could find it. And it was a very dry blog, actually. It was hosted on Blogspot. Every day I just wrote down what I studied.
I
And
think
that
you
was
even
really the
included the
beginning.
page numbers.
That's right. So I would include things like open this book, do problems 27 through 80. And then I provided some editorial commentary on the lessons I was learning for the given day.
Okay.
So a very kind of I think not extraordinary beginning. And at the time, only my girlfriend, who's now my wife, was reading the blog. Maybe my parents, but somehow a community started to develop with no outbound word of mouth on my part.
Was it a community when it was on Blogspot?
So it didn't start as a community, but it began to become a community. As I started preparing for the journey, I think the story somehow got picked up by other folks who had maybe similar circumstances to my own, who are self-studiers. And people were starting to email me, starting to comment on my blog posts more and more. Towards the end of my prep, I was actually fielding between 50 and 100 emails a day. From folks around the world who also wanted some advice on their prep. I realized towards the end that I developed a little bit of an expert brand around self-studying.
By the end, you mean when you were selling the company?
No, by the end of when I finished preparing for the GMAT test.
Okay. So how did it
So
help you in your test to have gone through this process?
I'm someone who's a big fan of public shaming. And what I mean by that is if I need, if I'm going to be accountable for something that's important in my life at a given time, I like to actually make it as public as possible so that the people who I care about most, and maybe even some strangers, will hold me accountable when I if I slip. So for me, it was very important to prepare for the test every day just a little bit and not fall off the wagon. And well, I thought that blogging would just be the ultimate sort of public forum to keep me going in my prep.
At what point did you move from Blogspot at Blogger to your own site?
Yeah, so what happened was I found this amazing deal. It was $4, and I can get 6 months of free host 6 months of hosting as well as my own domain name. And this was about a year after I'd finished studying for the test, but still the emails were coming from people who were preparing for the test. And frankly, what happened was I was just getting really tired of answering all these emails. And I clearly had a very intelligent community, and I thought, hey, if the person who's good at math could help the person who's good at verbal and vice versa, maybe we can form some sort of online study structure where I don't have to be the main bottleneck. So I took advantage of that $4 deal. I found that beatthegmat.com was still available at that point. And ever since then, actually, we've been cash flow positive.
So as a guy who saw this great opportunity on the Facebook platform, which was really taking off and making heroes out of entrepreneurs, did you look at Beat the GMAT and say, this is too small time? It's just on a Google blog. It's just this little tiny site that you pay $4 for every 6 months to run it, or for the first 6 months. Did you feel like it was too small?
So I think the thought never really crossed my mind until very, very late in the maturity of the business, maybe only in the last year or two. The reason why is this. When I started the blog, when I started to form a little bit later, I never had any intention of turning this into a business. This business that it has become happened completely out of serendipity and an accident. I mean, the site's just, the community sort of grew organically. I had a lot of passion in this space. One thing I didn't mention was I had a little bit of a test prep background myself during college. I taught some classes for the SAT and LSAT. And I've always been someone who's been really, oddly enough, passionate about standardized tests. I love them. And so
I also love them too, because it's so clear what you have to do. You don't know what the questions are going to be, but you do know what you need to do to prep. You do know what you need to do the day of. Not everything in life is that clear.
Well, I have a little bit of a different take on that, Andrew, which is, so the reason why I love them is that they're inherently a bit ridiculous in the sense that it's impossible to standardize intelligence by any means across, you know, the globe. So, you know, a lot of these tests, which are, tested worldwide, the audiences that they serve are going to be inherently different with regard to access to resources. You know, for us in the first world, let's say in the United States, perhaps we have more disposable income to buy a $1,500 course, but that could be a very different story for a colleague across the globe. And you're right, actually, that these tests, these intelligence tests, which they originally deemed to be in the 1950s and such, are ultimately preparable. You can do great if you have the right resources. And that was actually a really big reason
why. By the right resources, you just had books and a website. What kind of great resources did you have?
I had books and a website. I had internet access. You know, there are many places in the world where you cannot access, you can't even get your hands on a GMAT prep book. I have some community members who are based in Africa and parts of Southeast Asia who say that they go to their village's internet cafe 1 hour a day, which is the maximum limit, to log on to Beat the GMAT and access the resources that we're providing for free. And you know, for us, that's sort of like you and I have almost like access to all these steroids and whatever in this this grand race, whereas we're competing with other folks who have a lot
no
less.
No question that it's not fair. Yeah. That there are people who are disadvantaged. I just mean there's very little in life that's so cut and dried. You know, this interview, I don't know 100% if I prepared for it right. Is the question that I wanted to ask you the perfect question about ATM to get people excited, or is the one that I ended up going with about, you know, when we started chatting about our background, was that right? There is no clear right or wrong. But with an SAT or with a GMAT or other standardized test, there's a clear right or wrong. There's a clear way to prep. And is it a clear evaluation of your intelligence? I don't think so. But I do take comfort from the clarity of the right and wrong that comes from that.
Yeah, and there is even something, so I actually agree with your point there too. So I do think that there is something in the process of preparing. It's a really good indicator actually of how you are going to be as a student and how you prepare for the test. So as a proxy in terms of your preparedness, I think it's pretty good. But the original thesis that a standardized test could measure intelligence, inherent intelligence, I think that's completely been debunked. And to the credit of many of the test makers throughout the world today, I don't think they're trying to position their tests as intelligence tests anymore.
Yeah. All right. So here you are, a guy who's learning this publicly, who's building the site. You're starting to bring in revenue through AdWords, right?
Yep, actually, that's right.
Excuse me, it's called AdSense when it's placed on the site. And so you're basically not breaking even, maybe making a little bit of money, but you're not flush.
Right.
And then I see a post from 2006 on Ramit Sethi's blog where you basically say, a few months ago, I launched forums, except you wouldn't even let him call it just forums at the time. You said, I launched a community. And you explained the thought process behind it. But once you launched it, how did it do? Was it active? Was it doing well? Or did it become one of those, just another forum with hardly any action on it?
Yeah. So Ramit, by the way, great mutual friend of ours, he was one of the guys that tried to convince me not to spend any time on this project.
Why?
Well, for some of the things that you mentioned even earlier in this interview, which is the long-term size of this market is pretty small. There's only 250,000 GMAT test takers every year. It's a tiny, tiny community. So how do you make money off that? And we found our way, but it hasn't been, of course, the easiest. And the scale by which we have grown hasn't been at the same size as Facebook, which also started at the same time, the BTGMAT, roughly. To answer your question about how we started, I thought that I could just flip a switch, turn on the discussion forums, and the community would start talking. But I learned that I was absolutely wrong about that. Interacting with a site via blog comments is very different from interacting with a site through discussion forums.
What's the difference?
The main difference is that there's actually a lot more steps typically in how a discussion forum is structured, in that you have to register a user account. There is a little bit of an odd usability issue of being able to be comfortable with picking threads, scrolling through threads, finding the reply button. It seems to be a bit of a cleaner interaction story when you're just hitting reply to a blog comments.
Yeah.
So we had to train that community to do that, but really the way that the community was able to hit that critical mass, and that was a concept I was always obsessed with, which was the idea that we would have a community that's large enough and active enough where if I had to go away suddenly, the community itself would still grow and thrive and just continue to flourish. It took about, I'd say, a good year and a half for us to achieve that critical mass. Yeah, and the way that we did it was actually through three principles, actually. The first was high quality content. If you, Andrew, wrote a post on my discussion forum, I would personally respond to it in a very, very thorough manner. So the first value is, you're going to get a response from me, and it's going to be a great response. The second principle was speed. So I never made this public, but for about a year, I would try to answer every single forum post within 1 hour. And the problem with that is I soon discovered that when America wakes up and goes to sleep, India and China then, wakes up and goes to sleep. It's a 24-hour cycle.
Yep.
So what I did was I programmed some phone alarms that would go off every time a new forum post was entered in my site. I tried to drop whatever I was doing, run to a computer, and answer that forum post. So it took me about a year of doing that before we got to some sizable growth.
Okay.
And then the third and final principle, actually to me it was the most important, which was what I call be a hippie. So what I mean by that is at the time, there was a prevalence of business school related communities that had highly negative community members, where it was very common to thrash other members who were trying to get some honest advice about their profile, their competitiveness in getting into these higher education programs. And I was absolutely sick of it. I thought that it was a misrepresentation of what real MBA students were, of students seeking higher education in general. So Be a Hippie to me was, as soon as someone shows even the faintest hint of becoming a troll or someone who's a negative energy in the community, we would immediately ban them. Without any warning, they'd just be gone from our site. That was one component of it. The second is my own persona when the site actually became, I don't know how to describe it, maybe effervescent. So I'm someone who actually is a grammar Nazi, and I hate using emoticons and multiple exclamation points. But I found that I use those and leverage those as tools within my community when I communicate to others, because I wanted to set the tone within our community as someone who's absolutely encouraging, caring, always excited about having you in the site. And it had tremendous secondary effects of making the rest of the community really effervescent and friendly. So to this day, I still see, I don't participate in the community that much anymore, but to this day, we still have an incredibly friendly and encouraging community. So it was really through those three principles and just working at it for about a year and a half where we were finally able to get that point where the site was just grown by itself.
I'm looking here through my research as we're talking. At some point very early on, you also asked people who are experienced with the GMAT to come into the message boards, to be there, to help answer questions. How did you get them to participate?
So a lot of things happened once we hit that critical mass point.
So this was before or after the critical mass?
This is right around the point where we hit that inflection where the site was starting to take off. Recruiting experts became very, very easy. And we have a very great value prop here in terms of how we run our business, in that we don't charge students directly on our site. All the resources you find on Beat the GMAT are free. Who we do charge, though, are test prep companies, business schools, admissions professionals, and coaches. And what they find is that by participating in our site and providing free advice, lots and lots of free advice, it becomes a lead channel for them. So if I'm coaching some people in our discussion forums, this young man, Andrew, and Andrew will very likely be impressed by the expert, and he'll say it's me. He may reach out to me and ask for one-on-one tutoring. And one-on-one tutoring is a great business. I mean, you can get thousands and thousands of dollars just from a single client.
Oh, I see.
So there are many, many experts in our site today who are admissions people, GMAT companies, who are building pretty good empires themselves just getting Beat the GMAT leads into their business.
Did you make that offer to them, that pitch to them, when you brought them into the group?
Yeah, so what I was ultimately trying to do was accelerate the critical mass of our site. And the way that I saw that was going to happen was if we can get a ton of experts on the site who are providing tons of free content and free advice, not just me, but maybe like 100 other people, then it's going to be really enticing for someone who's preparing for the test to join our community and start to participate. And so that was the first thing that I was trying to solve for. And then it just so happened, through a lot of experimentation and discussion with the experts, hey, there's huge value back to you. If you participate a lot and devote many hours a week to our site, you're going to make money. Like, you can actually measure that down to the cent. And in fact, today we have probably a little bit less than 100 experts who are active on our site. The folks who are the most active in our leaderboard right now at the bottom of our site, they tell me all the time that they hate to go on vacation because they don't want to lose the brand reputation and their leaderboard stack ranking by going to Hawaii for a week. So they just continue to work and provide lots and lots of free content to our community.
So if someone's listening to us and says they want to create a community, or if I, Andrew, want to create a community based on what I've learned from you, would it make sense for us to bring in experts and say, we've got this? Are you getting an alert?
No, I just closed it, yeah.
Oh, would it make sense for us to do that too, to bring in experts and say, you will get business if you answer questions, we will help you raise your profile with this audience?
So I think that's a pretty good way to go, but there's a step before that that's really important. So the step before is you need to demonstrate that you have the traffic. and you actually have a vibrant community. And in order to pull that off, it's just pure grit, really, of doing a lot of work yourself, serving as that expert. A lot of the times you have to be driven just from the passion of the business you're trying to build, because it's grueling. It's not very easy work.
What about this thing that you're, and I'm going to say one other thing that you did to get people to come to your site, but what about this idea that you're not the expert? You're a guy who took the test. You didn't even graduate, as you said.
Yeah. So I didn't get an MBA. I did finish the GMAT test. I actually did take it. Here's the thing though, is, we need to sort of define what expert actually means. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to be someone who knows everything about algebra or geometry or whatever subjects are tested on the GMAT test. What I am an expert at was understanding how to build a strong and effective self-study plan to prepare and succeed on the GMAT test. So this is the most niche area of expertise that I have, just based on solving for my own needs in the past of what did I need to do to prepare for the GMAT test. That's what I'm an expert at. I can't really even tell you, I probably can't even do any of the simple kind of probability questions anymore that's tested on the GMAT. But in that one specific area, I do know what I'm talking about.
Because you went through that public study period where you blogged and talked about it and learned it and shared.
That definitely was the main reason I built that brand. But the second was just because I made it public. The sheer fact that this is a public experience and that you could see me starting from someone who had absolutely zero knowledge of the test to becoming very, very proficient in that subject matter and in the test from day zero to day 60. I'm kind of one of those guys who you see on the infomercials for P90X who started fat and then now has a six pack. And you can see my journey each step of the way. So that sort of has, I think, been the enabling factor for me to build some expertise or have that brand as an expert.
That is encouraging. And I've got to tell you that one of the things that I do for my guests, or to make sure that my guests are telling me the truth, is I go back in time and I see, did what they say happen? If they're talking about 2006, are there any contemporary articles from 2006 where what they're telling me today is the same as what they said back then? And I watch your growth. I see it. And I didn't just pick 2006 out of the air. I see that the interview that you did with Ramit was from 2006, and you guys were both new into the publishing space back then.
That's right.
All right. So here's another thing that you told Jeremy Weiss in the incredible pre-interview that he did with you. You said that you would bring people from outside into your site by doing what? Do you know what I'm talking about? You would somehow overhear a conversation about the GMAT and you would chime in and bring people over to your site. How would you do that?
Are you talking about in real life?
Or I don't know. You tell me. Was it in real life, or did you have Google Alerts set up so that if someone talked about the GMAT, you'd go and get them?
So in the early days, there was a lot of hand-to-hand combat. I mean, it was just straight-up guerrilla warfare where if I saw someone who I could talk to who was struggling on a problem that I knew that I could solve through having them join our community, I would personally recruit them. And that happened through a lot of channels. So that's part of the reason why I'm struggling to answer this. One of the ways that this happened was in the early days, when I was doing the blog, I was still living on campus at college. So I had the opportunity to talk to people who are graduating, discuss, you know, whether they're going to get their MBA degrees or not, and just let them know that I had this blog on Blogspot that they could check out. A little bit later on, though, the hand-to-hand combat happened both online as well as offline. So I would sometimes I would read other people's blogs as well. So one of the things that I'm very proud of as a kind of a small legacy in the internet is the Beat the GMAT blog was one of the first of its genre in terms of a day-to-day study blog. But since then, there have been thousands that have spawned from it. So as soon as I discover GMAT blogs, and I did have Google Alerts for that too, I would start to comment on those sites. I would start to engage in those readers and invite them to either, you know, share their experiences to our community, or even just start to directly participate. You know, one of the articles that I recently saw from Paul Graham, you know, one of your former interview subjects from the founder of Y Combinator, is his title. It was titled, do things that don't scale. I'm sort of paraphrasing. Those
I
sort of
think you
the,
might even have it exactly right.
yeah. So I read it just a couple of weeks ago, but his whole point is, you know, in the early days, you know, don't worry about setting up systems that will get you from 0 to 1 million people. It's all about getting those users one by one. So I knew inherently that when I programmed alarms to wake up at 3 o'clock to answer some guy's post from India, that I wouldn't be able to do that forever. I'd probably end up actually dropping over and dying because it was really exhausting. However, it was effective because I knew that I was solving for that person's experience really, really well. And my bet was that by solving that guy's post or that girl's problem really well in my community, they're going to tell 12, 15, 20 other people when they're ready to prepare for the GMAT test. So that was kind of the thinking around, like, you know, this guerrilla warfare is really going to pay off at some point, because I'm banking on the idea that delivering a great experience will deliver a great word of mouth that I don't even need to work for at that point.
You know, I hear what you're saying, and still I think about this past Saturday that I was at this party, and when people asked me what I did, I didn't want to say Mixergy. I didn't want to talk to them about this because I thought, what's the best thing that's going to happen? I end up with another five viewers on my site. Is there a benefit to doing that? If you count up all the people who you met, would it be that dramatic an impact on your traffic?
So a couple things. First of all, you should never be shy about mentioning that you run Mixergy. That's something you should be absolutely proud of. I mean, I've seen the earliest work that you've produced, and you've come a very long way. So that's the one thing. The second thing, though, is measuring success has to be a little bit different in the education space. So is it worth it? So I gain. Let's say that I could talk to 5 to 10 people each week, which is probably the right number through these unscalable channels. I still do this to convince them to come visit the site. I am not I'm not that interested in having them hand me over money indirectly. You know, it's great that they're growing my traffic, and that's inherently valuable. But there's something a little bit more exciting around our venture and Beat the GMAT, which is I can help 5 to 10 people a week to get better resources to help them achieve their dreams for graduate education. Mm-hmm. So what you know, is that worth my time? I think absolutely yes, because, you know, helping someone to achieve their dreams in education, you know, that's something that is taken for granted a lot, I think, in the United States, is this access to education. Elsewhere in the world, you know, it's a little bit harder to obtain. And any part that my team and I can do to help those folks become successful, that's a huge win. You know, that's one of the things I liked most about the Beat the GMAT project was I never thought that there's never a single day in this venture where I thought that I could fail. If I had to close up shop today, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, it would have been totally cool because I knew for a fact that at least I had a chance to help a couple thousand people. And then it became a couple tens of thousands of people. Then it became hundreds of thousands. And now it's millions of people. So regardless of whether it actually created great, you know, liquidity for me, this sort of social mission was the thing that really kept us going and made us very proud.
I get that. And you know what? Actually, what I ended up doing was I did talk about not Mixergy, but this other project that I'm doing with the Mixergy community about meditation, about shutting out those the inner doubt. And the reason I did it was not to send people to a site. I actually don't really have a website to send them to, but I wanted to see how strangers who didn't know me would understand the message. Am I communicating it well? Something that Mike Del Ponte told me of Soma, the water pitcher that he created. He said, I just needed a place to test my explanation of what's special about this product and see what excites people. And, and in that sense, it really helped. Did you find that too?
Absolutely. I mean, so I love talking about Beat the GMAT. The thing that I love about it so much is that 99% of the people that I meet in daily life cannot relate to the site at all. So, you know, most of my friends are not MBAs, and most of the people I talk to on a day-to-day basis are not seeking MBA education. But the opportunity to sort of just explain what we do, why I'm passionate, and just try to see if I can get them passionate too about the idea, it's really rewarding because you never know when they have a relative or another friend who could use a little bit of advice, and you know, we could be there for that community, with that community. So I just love pitching to people who have no idea what I do, and try to get them excited about the GMAT. I mean, what a Interesting challenge that is, right?
What do you say to get someone who doesn't care about the GMAT excited about it?
So I don't talk about the test specifically. I don't even talk about the MBA degree specifically either. What I try to talk about is the fellowship that you're going to find in our community, where there's a rare place on the internet where everyone's kind to you. And no matter what stage you are in your maturity or your preparedness for the test, for your MBA admissions, you can go there and know that you're going to get a respectful and very, very friendly response to any question that you have. Today, the average response time for a Beat the GMAT question that comes into our discussion community is 5 minutes. And that's a lot better than the 1 hour I was even trying to achieve myself Wow. back in the day. And that's something that I think gets people excited, is knowing that, you know, hey, you know, this is not maybe relevant to me, but it's cool to see that on the internet, you can find communities that behave well, that are respectful to one another. It's not like the YouTube community or other places that you might find, which are far more vitriolic in terms of their tone. And I think that gets them excited.
I'm checking that right now as we're talking, and I see, of course, if I check the description of your site on even Google, it says a GMAT and MBA community featuring free GMAT forms. But even going back to an email that you sent me 2-3 years ago where you said what your company does, you said, we're relaunching an MBA social network. It was never Yeah. about beating the GMAT. It was never about just the test. It was always about the community.
That's right. Yeah, I'm surprised you still have that email. I actually do not remember sending it to you at all.
Yeah, I've got emails from you going all the way back. I won't read them because anything personal, I'll keep personal. The Yeah. very first email exchange that we had is from 2010.
Wow. Okay. I've been a fan for a long time, Andrew.
I appreciate it. And I can see even in my emails too, I think there are a few exclamation points when I'm looking, when I was looking at your site.
Yeah.
So somewhere around the time that you and I talked, I guess it was even before that, 2009, you launched a social network and you wanted to redesign it and you needed to fund it. Did you even try going out to get investors to invest in the business?
So, not really. And what I mean by that is we did have some inbound interest, especially in the last couple of years, from folks who are who said that if you needed any seed investment, we'd have it available for you. So we knew that the capital was accessible to us, but you know, we are very proud of our bootstrapping legacy and wanted to do whatever was possible to keep Beat the GMAT privately held. So that we can ultimately control our own destinies too. So what we did was, back in 2009, we wanted to relaunch as a social network, not just a discussion forum, but a place where we can create some real substantive bonds mm-hmm. with fellow applicants as well as administrators at schools and students and so forth. And the way that we pulled that off was what I call pitching vaporware. So we needed about $100,000 to $150,000 in order to pull off this big redesign. And what we did was we invested in a designer, paid him $5,000 to create some mock-ups of key parts of the site and the user experience. And when we went to some potential clients whom we would sell this to, we basically said, you know, production is already happening. You know, development's underway. And if you want to be part of the launch and have the privilege of being there from day one, you're going to have to pay us 6 months in advance, all cash, all up front. And we were able to close. What were they paying for? So we were actually seeking out service providers for GMAT prep and admissions consulting, you know, people who are in the pre-admission stage, you one would say. And they wanted to have access to some of the new marketing products that we were applying for them. So it was a combination of advertising, lead gen, lots and lots of branding. For the sites, it's been a model. It's actually been the same business model we've been running for the last 5 years, and it's been working really well. And so, you know, the clients loved it. They loved the concept. We got the money, and then we started to build. And we had to pretty much deliver something within 3 or 4 months, but we were able to do so and pull off a really successful launch.
How about there? Did you feel like a fraud at that point?
Not at all. I mean, so. Maybe we were being slightly hyperbolic by saying that the production was underway, but we were doing a lot of work already assuming that the cash was in hand. So I was I'm a product manager. I kind of consider myself a product manager. And you know, I was already drafting the user experience, the requirements. I was sort of mocking out the flow of what the site was going to look like. And while we didn't have any developers coding it yet, I was already confident that we're going to make it happen. So, and here's the other thing too, which is I didn't see this as a huge gamble, meaning if we got the money, I did not think that we were not going to deliver. Mm-hmm. So the confidence actually, I think, also sort of was manifest in my pitch. But that was not something I never questioned, which I knew that the exact scope of what this project had to be, and that we were going to deliver it. So I felt very good about pitching early, monetizing, then building.
And how long did it take you to actually relaunch the site?
About 3 or 4 months. That was when we got our first launch. We did another bit of tweaking, I think, about 2 or 3 months after that. So, I mean, it was a real iterative process, but towards the end of that full 6 month, we had the final site that that really lasted us for quite some time, actually, for another good 2 years before we did another relaunch.
One of the first things I do when I move to a new city is I don't worry about much. I actually enjoy having a brand new environment. The thing that though worries me is, will I be able to get health insurance? Because I run my own company, I have to find my own health insurance, and I don't have the patience to deal with those bureaucrats, and for random reasons they could turn you down, or they can stalk you if they decide that they love you and keep trying to pitch you. So as an entrepreneur, a guy who's running his own business, no outside funding, doing this for years, what did you do about health insurance?
So health insurance was probably the single largest source of stress in my life.
Really?
As an entrepreneur. Yeah. When I started my career back in 2005. So Beat the Gmail was a side project. I was working at a large tech company for 3.5 years. They put me in Arizona at the call center as part of this rotational program. Awesome experience. But I went camping one day in the desert, and I came back from the trip contracting a very, very rare lung disease.
Wow.
And I actually had to fight for my life for about 8 years on this disease. I later learned that I actually had only a 15% survival rate. So it was a very, very tough time because I was uninsurable, absolutely uninsurable.
Because they won't after that pick you up.
Nope, not at all. I have a pre-existing condition. So, you know, fortunately I had Cobra for a period of time. I also had my wife's insurance too through her employer and her Cobra as a result. But it was really just managing a variety of Cobra, by the way, just to your listeners, is the health insurance that you can extend from your company by paying the full premium month to month, usually for about 12 to 18 months, depending on the state that you had. It's incredibly expensive. For me, I was
paying the corporate rate as an individual.
That's right. So for me individually, I was paying about $700 to $800 a month just for myself. And as an entrepreneur, at times where I did not pay myself for 6 months, spending $800 was actually at times a decision between, should I buy these kinds of groceries or should I buy the canned goods and then you know, pay my health insurance?
What do you do when Cobra expires?
So you're pretty much screwed. Maybe Obamacare is going to change that. So that's one thing to look out for. I don't really know too much of the details yet, but hopefully it'll improve things. But the way that we are able to solve for that is we had a very brief lapse after sort of juggling the Cobras where we didn't have health insurance. At that point, our business was large enough where we can get enough employees as full-time members so that we can buy new group insurance.
Oh, wow.
So that I would not be judged as an individual, but the company as a group would pay in. So that's how we were able to ultimately get coverage, was just hiring people so that we can get the group rates. But man, was it stressful. I mean, I thought, not only was it the stress of possibly dying, but it was also the idea that, you know what, I may not be able to see this vision through that I have for this company. And that depressed me so much, thinking like maybe it's time for me to get a big company job, you know, where I can sort of have a little bit more flexibility with my time, focus on my health, and give up this Beat the GMAT thing. And the thought of that scared me more than anything, just
really?
The idea that I had unfinished business that I could possibly leave behind.
You actually were basically taken out for, I think, 3 months is what you told Jeremy. How does your business, the one that relied on you for a long time, answering posts within minutes of people putting it up on your site, how does that kind of a business run without you for 3 months? What did you do to allow it to run?
Well, going back to this whole concept of critical mass, the community itself was thriving. So my participation was not critical from, let's say, community health perspective. So I didn't need to participate too much myself to make the site to run. The business side, though, you know, making sure that our clients were happy and so forth, that was a little bit tough. I probably didn't have as much downtime as I would have hoped for in hindsight. Mm-hmm. During my 3 months off from work. You know, there's still a lot of time after watching tons of Netflix and just being on a couch. You know, my mind was fine and my body was a bit sore, but I could still type. So I was able to do some emails here and there. For the most part, I think that none of my clients actually knew ever that I was sick. I've only recently started to tell them about these crazy experiences that my wife and I have had. And they've been surprised. But, you know, it might have been also slightly therapeutic to some degree because, you know, the thing that gets me most excited about my day is just coming to work and doing the thing that I love to do, which is building this business. And, you know, if I didn't have that, then I would just sort of be lost in my thoughts about, okay, I'm 25 and I didn't live that long. Am I going to die? You know, it's very easy for me to, I guess, start scale a little bit lost if I didn't have something that really occupied my time like this.
You know, one of my past interviewees, though, Sam Carpenter, who wrote the book Work the System, says, if a business can't run without you, it's not really a business, it's a job. So did you ever convert it into a business? Or was it kind of like Mixergy is still to this day?
I make it a job. I think that
prefer it that way.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So we have gone on vacation for like 5 weeks at a time, or you know, we take 3 weeks off or 4 weeks off every year or two to travel, and the business comes back. We come back to the business and it was better than before. Our team is quite large now, actually. We got acquired last year, but there's about 11 or 12 people running the business outside of just me. And but I like having the job. I mean, being able to talk to community members on a day-to-day basis, hear about their hopes and dreams, and you know, hear about what inspires them. It's just so much fun. And I haven't been bored in the last 9 years of just getting involved.
So then what got you to sell?
I think what got me to sell was actually sort of what Ramit said, which was a little bit 9 years later, I kind of got the advice, which is he said to me that back in 2005, when we were both 23 years old, he said, Eric, don't do this because there's no long-term scaling opportunity for this. And I actually think that there is long-term scaling opportunities, but it's going to be a very different journey starting from the next 10 years than it was in the last 10 years. In the sense that, you know, we're looking at new opportunities in different education spaces now, not just the MBA space. So let's say like law, medicine, nursing, other kinds of graduate education verticals. In order for us to pull that off, though, I do think that it's going to take more capital. I think it's going to take a little bit more existing relationships with those kinds of graduate programs that I didn't have myself. And on the one hand, I thought it was great for business to align myself with a company that had a huge footprint in these different spaces. The second thing, though, is it was 8 years, 9 years of running this business. And we made a lot of sacrifices along the way in terms of our own financial stability. I'm at a place, you know, Andrea, you and I were talking right before this interview about, you know, families and when's the right time to have kids. My wife and I are pretty much at that point where we're thinking pretty seriously about having children. And it's important to me as a sort of naturally conservative guy to have some financial liquidity that we can rely on moving forward to provide for my family. So there's a bit of business, but there's also personal in terms of liquidity.
Do you think Ramit's site is built to scale, or is it also a job? Ramit doing personal finance where he is the personal finance guru of the site.
You know, Ramit's one of my heroes because he's a guy that's very, very good at working himself out of a job. And what I mean by that is no doubt he put in a lot of sweat equity and attention to building the site for many years, and especially in the beginning days. But he has built such a smart team where he recruits amazing talent to build great products, to do a lot of the writing for him even in some cases, where he can focus on the things that is fun for him, which is, you know, the occasional blog posts, the interviews. But his team is really, really good now and does much of Ramit's work. So I think he also has a job. I think that it has some scaling potential. And I think that Ramit could have a business that runs without him and just leverages his brand. But he's also a guy that I think is in it for the hand-to-hand combat of everyday work too, because he also loves his job.
He does seem to. Anyone who sent him an email and got a response within 4 minutes knows how committed he is.
It's a bit scary, yeah.
During the sale of the business, something happened to your wife.
Yeah, so that is pretty much the scariest moment and also the darkest moment of my life. So things were going great. This was almost exactly a year ago, mm-hmm. where we were in the process of going through our due diligence. We had negotiated much of the terms of our business. And my wife and I decided to go on a trip with some friends to go down a river gorge. We decided to free climb out of it because we thought through our own hubris that we're awesome climbers, and we did a lot of rock climbing. Mm-hmm. And my wife ended up falling like 70 feet off a cliff, free climbing in her bathing suit. And the only thing that saved her was actually a tiny little shrub that was sticking out of the canyon that kind of helped to break her fall, that she catch her foot on. Exactly, just like Wile E. Coyote. Uh-huh. So she was severely injured. She was bedridden for a couple weeks too. And this was happening right in the middle of the deal. So I had to go back to the deal makers on the other side, and I said, hey, listen, this happened. I just got to take care of personal business and you know, step away. And to the credit of the company that I'm with now, Hobsons, they're so cool about it. I mean, they were just amazing. In terms of saying, no problem at all, you know, we'll try to do as much work as possible on our side. You don't worry about it. Just come back when you're ready. And then I was a caretaker for about 3 or 4 weeks for my wife. And I don't know if you've been in a position of being a caretaker before, Andrew, but it is, I have so much respect for people who can do this for extended periods of time. I mean, you are doing laundry all the time. You're cooking all the time. You're cleaning and changing bandages all the time. Simple things like remembering to shower, remembering to eat, remembering to sleep yourself, like all just very basic human needs you absolutely throw out the door and lose complete track of. And so it's very easy for people to just lose it. But fortunately, I'm blessed with some wonderful friends and family who were able to check in on me, remind me to eat and sleep and shower.
You have family here?
I do have some family. I have a sister nearby and her family, and my parents are pretty close too in LA. I'm in San Francisco area. So that made all the difference. And
I can't imagine, but she recovered that quickly?
So, you know, it took her a good 4 to 5 months, I say, to get back at it, but she didn't break any bones. She really severely lacerated her body in many areas, like very, very deep, but you know, it's amazing how resilient human bodies are. Like, she could start to get pretty mobile even after 2.5 weeks. But there's been at least a full year of kind of recovery in terms of the treatments she's applying to her skin and so forth. And the psychological trauma is actually pretty strongly felt even today with both of us. I mean, I was at the bottom of the cliff watching my wife fall. And, you know, I always sort of maybe was dismissive of people who say they have post-traumatic stress disorder. I never thought that was a real thing, but you know, I had nightmares very, very consistently about that fall.
Where you would see her fall.
For many months. And I now, I think, have recommitted myself to taking those kinds of things much more seriously.
I hate to even bring it back to business from that.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, it's all related to business. I mean, we still had to close the deal too. And that was, you know, at that point too, it just didn't seem to matter. That's the thing that was kind of interesting that I learned, which is when the people you care about most really need you, it's amazing how quickly your what stresses you out about your day-to-day business life and lots of money on the line, it just suddenly doesn't matter anymore. A little funny sort of side note too, in terms of what I learned about myself. So there's a period of time where I thought I was a sociopath, because towards like the height of running this company, I was only focused on making sure that I was optimizing my business. I was seeing like time with friends and family as opportunity costs from working. Mm-hmm. And I started to get a little bit concerned about, you know, am I losing my human touch? But you know, it took an incident like this to really rapidly remind me of, wow, like I do care about these people, and I am recommitting myself to caring about them and appreciating them every day. But I don't know if you felt that. I know that in one of your previous startups, it was super intense, and just, you know, it's very easy to lose yourself into just becoming a business guy day and night. That's all you think about.
I did have to work on it because you're right. I saw people as opportunity costs, as distractions from what I needed to do, or helpers.
Yeah.
And I had to work on it. I still frankly have some intimacy issues where I can really connect with Olivia and we have a lot of intimacy, but one of my past guests, Nicholas Holland, came in here and we just had this real personal conversation. He said, Andrew, you need to, forget how he said it, but you need to have close friends, essentially. Like, are we buds? He says to me, are we buds? And I go, yeah. He goes, no, we're not. We don't know each other that well. You need people who you can get to know really well. And I thought, I need to actually work on that, because it doesn't come naturally to me. I feel like I know a lot of people. I'm close with a lot of people. I have a lot of people come home for drinks, for dinner, et cetera, but I need to work on getting closer.
Well, here's a thought for you. This experience with my wife completely defined who was actually.
I'm not about to throw my wife down any cliff.
Yeah,
that's what you're getting at.
Just learn from my lesson.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is, you know, the real friends I discovered were the ones who, not necessarily just called or emailed, said, "Hey, is everything all right?" But they actually showed up at my doorstep, and then they let themselves in when I was going through this crazy caretaking process. They didn't ask to do my laundry, but they did it for me. They cooked meals for me. They're the ones who didn't ask for anything, or even, you know, they just showed up and then acted. And it kind of reminds me of a quote that I read recently, which is like, your true friends are the ones that come running towards you during times of crisis. And what I've sort of committed to myself is, anytime that we have friends that need us, we're not going to call them or email. We're just going to show up at the door and, you know, be there in person until they can get through this. And so that's sort of, I think, my definition of a true friend. Something to think about for you too, Andrew.
I get that. And I think I need to do, I don't get opportunities to do it more. Maybe I'm not finding it, but I have to tell you that one of the things I recognize as I say these as I talk in these interviews is I want to get really vulnerable about myself, so that because I know when I have private conversations with people in the audience, they get really vulnerable with me, and I'm trying to be as open about my challenges, my vulnerabilities as they are with me. So hopefully others will see themselves in this, but I don't want to make it feel like all I have is these vulnerabilities. In fact, I feel, if anything, at this stage of my life, so comfortable in my own skin, so comfortable Sure. expressing myself. And maybe that's where a lot of this openness comes from.
Well, I think the vulnerabilities are great to express too. I mean, I don't think anyone who's actually seen your interviews define you by vulnerabilities. But in some sense, actually, entrepreneurship might be a definition of controlling your vulnerabilities. I mean, there's constant insecurity in terms of skill gaps that you have, questioning yourself, doubting yourself. And unfortunately, sometimes it produces very sad results. In the case of Aaron Schwartz or Joey Sherman, who, you know, unfortunately had to pass. And what I think is happening, though, especially in Silicon Valley and perhaps elsewhere, is a little bit of a realization that we need to act a little bit more human in our day-to-day lives and feel comfortable.
I think another challenge is we go through our own private hells at times. I think all of us do. But when we look at other people, they never look like they're going through it, because they always put on a brave face.
Yeah.
If you even talk to them about the past, they're reluctant to say anything openly about their challenges. And so you feel like, what is wrong with me? Am I the only one who has this? I imagine, I don't know the gay community that well, or I haven't. I imagine that when I watch old movies of gay experience from years ago, that gay people must have had that feeling too, that what is wrong with me? Am I the only one like this? Why can't
yeah.
I stop this? And I feel it doesn't have to be. We are not, when we go through this, we're not the only ones. And when I talk to people like even Mark Suster in an interview, a guy who's really confident, who's personable. When I don't just talk to him about the confidence and I don't just talk to him about his business success, I think I do the audience a service. I think I show them, here's a guy who was also vulnerable. Here's a guy who also thought that he was going through something he could never get out of. And when you're going through it, recognize that you're not alone, that others get through it. And I think that's helpful.
And what, you know, I completely agree with that. Just one of the lies that I'd like to stop hearing in the Valley is, you know, when you ask, hey, how's business going? Crushing it.
Yes.
You know, I and I'm guilty. I've said it before too, trying to convince myself that I'm crushing it. But what I've learned is actually that's not a very healthy thing to keep contributing back. Like, the truth is usually I'm not crushing it. Usually shit's going wrong. there's a lot on my mind. And
I don't even want to say that we should always, when someone says, how are things going, we should always say, well, I've got this headache here and I don't know if I'm going to make it. I'm just saying there needs to be a space where we can talk about it, a space where we can say, this is what we're going through. Anyone else going through it? Okay, great. How do we express it so we can release it and learn from each other?
That's right. Hopefully these kinds of interviews too are helping. I mean, you do get very personal with the people you interview. So we're all human here, right? I mean, there are great times or really bad times, and I hope that some of these stories I shared today with you were helpful too.
I know they are. I almost want to end it here because it's such a touching moment, and I know this is where you want to end it, where you've touched someone and left them with a message, but I also want to be complete. And there's something really important that you said in the notes that unfortunately is going to bring me back to business, but it's still important.
Sure.
You said something about the structure of your business, that if you would have structured it differently, it would have been better for you financially, especially with relations to taxes. I didn't fully understand it, and I thought I'd ask you directly.
So, for those of you who are in the audience watching this right now, this is a very big lesson that I learned, which is if you have a choice in terms of how you incorporate, don't do it as an LLC like I did, which is a very simple and elegant solution, but do it as a C Corp. Do it as a Delaware C Corp. What happens is there's this concept that I only recently learned about called qualified small business stock. And and the way that this works is, let's say that Andrew and I form a company today, a C Corp. We run our business for 5 years, and then it gets acquired. When we actually report the earnings, let's say that we make $1 million each, in some states, and definitely on the federal level, you can be completely exempt of taxes. And the reason why was, this is a law that really got a lot of attention was placed because during the recession, there's a lot of efforts on behalf of the government to incentivize people to create businesses and start to build jobs. And one of the huge exemptions in tax policy was, if we let people become entrepreneurs and then they build a business over 5 years and they get sold or liquidated, then we're going to let them defer or not pay any taxes at all. And if I had done that, I was an LLC. I didn't really have a good reason as to why I did that besides it was just easy. It would have produces a lot more liquidity for me that sadly, maybe not so sadly, it's in the government. I don't feel too bad about it actually, but it would have been just more personal liquidity.
Yeah, and I think you could have done, I've seen the good things you've done over the years, the scholarships that you started early on. I know you could have done good things with it. If nothing else, I just want to know that this is available. I had no idea. It's called the Qualified Small Business Stock?
Yep, QSBS. So definitely check it out on Google. It's not talked about enough, but it's a massive, massive benefit for starting a company today and doing it the right way through C Corp.
And I think, again, because we're in such a funded world, the issues of funded entrepreneurs are discussed a lot. The issues of unfunded entrepreneurs, like what do you do when you have profits? What do you do when you sell your business if you're a sole proprietor, for example? We just don't talk about it. And I'm glad that you started to raise the topic. There's one other thing that I promised the audience earlier in the interview. I didn't want them to think I cut you off because I'm avoiding the topic. I really wrote it down. You said you got out-innovated, and I wanted to come back and ask you how.
So when I entered the market with Beat the GMAT and our community, I think one thing that we did really well was we created a very friendly and encouraging community, for one. That's always been the prevailing value of our site. But the second thing, though, that we did really well was we dramatically simplified the user experience so that it would take you less steps. We're always convinced, we're always obsessed with the idea that we should have users take less steps in order to contribute or write or ask a question. And what started to happen was, this, I even hesitate to call this innovation, is that some of the other competing communities, believe it or not, there are other competing communities in this small space, they just started to copy our site. And you know, we didn't care. We thought that our traffic was unassailable, but it really did start to affect our traffic once we were able to bring our attention back to Beat the GMAT after we closed on our other business. And what we found is that they had done a great job in copying our user experience and also adding some other really great things to their own pipelines to make engagement easier. They'd had much better newsletter strategies and so forth to keep people engaged, not just on our site, but elsewhere on mobile and so forth. So we were a bit behind, and all our fault too. I mean, like, we had a very large pipeline of work that we could have accomplished in the year and a half that we decided to try this gaming experiment. And it took us probably a year and a half to 2 years to regain our footing and then to control the market again.
When you say we, who's we?
My team. So, you know, I have a very interesting team. My wife is actually, I should have mentioned this earlier, is one of my business partners. So as soon as we got married in 2009, went on our honeymoon, we came back, and then she quit her job at Accenture to join me full time as a professional services and marketing person. Mm-hmm. And then the other main business partner that I had, a guy named David, he was my former boss at Intuit. So when I quit, I hired him with me, and we went off to the races and running this business together. So the three of us were always the core team, but we had always a number of employees and contractors as well.
Well, this is such an inspiring story. What I love about it is it's bootstrapped. It started with nothing but a blog and a person who just wanted to learn and teach what he was learning along the way, and then a whole lot of love, for hippie style love for your community. Do you think a non-techie could build something like this?
Yeah, absolutely. I almost flunked out my entry-level CS class in college. I don't have a very good coding background myself. But we're in an age where there's some great tools available to allow you to put things on the web, to start online businesses.
What was your community platform?
WordPress for articles. And then our discussion community itself is this platform called PHPBB, PHP Bulletin Board. It's a free software you just download and then install on a server. And all open source, didn't cost me a dime. But yeah, I mean, the hard part is not really the tools or actually getting the technical know-how or sufficient technical know-how to get up and running. It's actually being persistent, being experimental, and figuring out how to build the audience. And I don't think you necessarily have to be an engineer in order to succeed in that. It just takes a lot of experimentation. So yes, I mean, for techies and non-techies alike, whoever's watching this, I really do hope that they can get some inspiration to do it themselves.
It is inspiring. And if people want to follow up with you and say thank you for doing this interview or share with you what they did based on what they learned, what's a good way for them to do it?
I like Twitter. So my name is Eric Bahn, E-R-I-C-B-A-H-N. That's my username on Twitter. So let me know what you're doing. I'd love to.
What are you working on right now? Where is that? So Raphael, the guy from CRV, showed me a software that he invested in, I guess. What is it called? Refresh. There it is. Refresh has been popping your name up on my iPhone all day to remind me, or maybe I'm just looking at it all day, to remind me that you're coming on. And here's what it says. April 30th, Eric has been working at BizDom for 4 months. His current title is mentor. What is that?
Yeah, so my day job, first of all, is I'm still working on Beat the GMAT as a director of product management at this company called Hobson's. It's a large education business. Mm-hmm. Love it there. But I have been stepping up my involvement in mentoring other companies. So BizDom is one of the accelerators that I'm advising. It's based in Detroit, which is my hometown. And I'm lucky enough to go out there once a quarter to talk to some very interesting companies and passionate people are trying to rebuild Detroit and actually build a vibrant tech hub. And they're doing a great job out there. So I'm involved in that. I do some work with Venture for America, which is sort of like a Teach for America, but gets young, talented graduates to spend 2 years of their lives building tech startups in struggling cities. And then, you know, advising some really wonderful companies. One in particular that I spend more time with is a company called Webflow. Check out webflow.com. It's a place that allows you to build mobile-friendly, responsive design sites all through WYSIWYG, just dragging and dropping. And it's a remarkable technology. I think it's actually going to change the way that people create things on the web. So I try to keep busy on the side too.
There's even more that I didn't talk about, but we'll leave it there. If anyone wants to go look it up, they can check out your LinkedIn profile, which again, refresh, brought up for me. This is actually really helpful for an interviewer like me, someone who meets a lot of new people.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out. That's really neat.
All right. Thank you all for being a part of this. Eric, thanks for both doing this interview and being a part of the Mixergy community for so long and being like one of my first customers for Mixergy Premium.
Thanks for the opportunity, Andrew, and keep up the good work.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.